Hi, this is Lisa Lieberman, and good afternoon, or whatever time it might be in your particular part of the world. What an incredible honor to be among this impressive lineup of presenters, and I hope you're all enjoying the opportunity to add to your knowledge in areas of interest to you. I'm a clinical social worker in private practice, an author, a national speaker, and most importantly, mom to a wonderful son, Jordan Ackerson, who has autism, who's now becoming a national speaker in his own right. I'm going to be sharing some concrete suggestions with you about how to make the experience of hiring one-to-one providers more positive and fruitful. Hiring providers can be a formidable task, and the process is not for the faint of heart. It takes much time and energy, but when you're done with the planning and the clarity that you come to, wonderful people can enter the circle of your family to support your child or young adult. My dear friend Valerie Paradis, who presented earlier today, told a story about how she found Elijah's first provider that was somehow a magical story, and I'm sure Val would agree with me that how she found that provider is the exception and not the rule. Hiring a quality provider is work, but as you will see, it's well worth the effort. Someone asked me a question in advance of the seminar about how to know if an ABA therapist is qualified to work with a child on spectrum, and I want to say from the beginning that this talk is not geared to any one particular approach or intervention. That being said, I trust that the information I share will provide a good solid foundation for assessing a quality candidate. Whether your child does ABA or floor time or RDI or the Miller method or rapid prompting or a multitude of approaches that are too numerous to name today. My book, A Stranger Among Us, is based in part on years of personal experience hiring providers for my own family members. Over the last 23 years, we've hired over 75 different providers in our home. My husband of 31 years, Craig Ackerson, has an advanced case of multiple sclerosis and needs total care. And our son, Jordan, who has autism, will be 22 next month. I'm proud of that guy, and I'm thrilled to be here, partly because of him. So let's get down to it. Let me read you a short passage from my book describing the point at which we knew it was time to be looking for an in-home provider. The phone rang. I was unearthing the contents of a box amid a formidable wall of moving boxes yet to be opened. Having just moved from out of state, few people had our telephone number, so I wondered who could possibly be calling. I answered the phone expecting a wrong number, and to my dismay, it was the family daycare provider where I had left my 2-year-old son, Jordan, less than an hour before. She insisted I come pick him up immediately, as he had been crying inconsolably for the past 45 minutes. This episode was yet another reminder of how our high-need child had never been able to thrive in previous group childcare settings. Although I desperately needed uninterrupted time to unpack, I quickly brought him home with a final resolve to choose a different path for childcare. It was no longer possible to ignore the emerging need to find care for him in his own home. So the next slide speaks for itself. These are the two men who have been my greatest teachers and inspiration for writing that book. This is my husband, Craig, and Jordan, who's our youngest son. In the short time we're together today, my goal is to discuss the following: assessing your family culture, writing a job description, and how to advertise, screen, and interview candidates. In other words, we'll cover what it takes to get a good candidate hired to the extent that this short seminar allows. So what do I mean by assessing your family culture? Before you begin the hiring process, think about who you are as a family. do what I call a family inventory by answering the 8 questions in this slide. Number 1, what are your predominant family values and beliefs? 2, do you tend to associate with people who have similar values, or do you enjoy spending time with diverse groups of people with different perspectives? 3, what is the role of spirituality or religion in your family? 4, what is the activity level or pace of your family life? Do you tend to be formal or casual in your dealings with people? Does your family thrive on routine or greater spontaneity? 7, how solid are the boundaries around your family? That is, do you tend to be open or private? And finally, do you have time to train a provider? Or is life so busy that you want someone with a lot of experience who can step in easily to the role of supporting your child or young adult? Answering these questions will help you to analyze and articulate who you truly are as a family. Once you've done that, you can identify traits in a potential provider that will be a good match for your family. So let me give you a few quick examples. If your family functions best in a quiet, calm atmosphere, then likely you'll be looking for someone with a patient, quiet demeanor rather than a high-energy, quick-paced, fast-talking individual who might throw your child into sensory overload. Another example, if your religion is a key part of your family life, then you might seek someone who's open-minded and will support your child to participate in your chosen religion. Again, how you answer these 8 questions will guide you to identify personality traits that will blend well with your child's needs in the context of your family. And I just want to do a quick reminder, if you're not already looking at the slides, there's a link on the left side of your computer screen for those who are online, and just click slides. Okay, we've discussed the importance of defining the desired qualities in a provider. Now it's time to think about what are the specific duties that you will require. Think about all the tasks that someone working with your child could do. Does your child need help with learning self-care and hygiene, homework, tutoring, life skills in the home or the community? Do you want someone who will support him to initiate social interaction or accompany her to an activity in the community? Somebody to drive him to therapy? A job coach? The list of potential duties could go on and on. So let yourself dream first as you make that list. Also, you might want to think about what you would expect beyond tasks that are directly related to working with your child, like somebody who might wash the dishes or start a load of laundry or make a salad. And for that matter, those tasks could be done with a child under the category of life skills. Your job description will also include what qualifications a candidate should have. Someone sent in a question asking about whether requirements for certification were listed anywhere. It's an important question without a uniform answer. It prompted me to do a Google search, and I was surprised at what I found. Most often, there were very minimal standards for providers on a state level. For example, Ohio's state requirements were the person needs to be age 18, have a GED or high school diploma, a Social Security card and a valid ID, not be on an abuser registry, able to read and write, able to do first aid and CPR, and they would need to have gone through an 8-hour orientation training. But there's no uniform national criteria for certifying providers, so we kind of have to invent the wheel in our own families based on our child's unique needs. So back to developing that job description. Now that you have your dream list, you would take time to prioritize the tasks that are of highest importance. And sometimes it's necessary to pick only the highest priority duties for a job description, depending on how many hours that person will be working. Think about what days and hours you would need somebody. In our situation, the number of hours shifted as our son matured. Earlier, he needed more help with self-care. But once he was in school, we had people working from 3 after school until 8 bedtime on school days. As he grew older, there wasn't a need to have people stay until bedtime. I've heard of other families hiring someone to come before school so everyone can get out the door in time. Or when a child has a home program or isn't yet in public school, multiple providers could be hired to job share for more hours. With our son, we preferred to have 2 people job share. We found that they could bring their unique strengths to the relationship, support each other, and if someone was sick or going on vacation, we had ready-made backup. So let's talk about how to get the word out that you're looking for in-home care or one-to-one providers in the community. Word of mouth is fine if you have access to people, groups, or agencies who might know prospective providers. We always had the best luck running a classified ad in the Help Wanted section of the newspaper. And in the end, it was always worth it to spend a little extra money to make that ad more appealing and to cut down on unqualified candidate responses. This is one time when more is better. So here are some things you should cover in an ad. Ads are usually run alphabetically by job title. It's even important to think about what message you're conveying just by the job title you've picked. For example, child care might attract babysitters. Caregiver could suggest caring for someone who's physically dependent, like my husband. So here's some additional job titles. Companion, tutor, mentor, support person, life skills specialist, inclusion support. You can think about other titles dependent on what duties you are needing at the time. You really should name the general locale that you live in if you're in a larger metropolitan area. What are the specific transportation requirements? For example, do you expect the person to have their own car, or is it good enough for them to have a valid driver's license and they'll use your car? Or is it enough that there be good bus access from their house to your house? What experience do you require? And specify in the ad that you will require references. So here are 3 sample classified ads, and in case people are not looking at the slides, I'd like to read them. And these are children or young adults with all different needs. Listen to these ads and notice the way they make the position sound more appealing. Personal care for loving boy 10 with autism, impaired vision, cognitive challenges. We seek respectful attitude, belief in possibilities, references required, and the phone number. Here's a second ad. Help develop community connections for teen boy with Asperger's. Positive, creative person who can make a difference in his life. Good driver, refs required, the phone number. And the last sample ad is companion for non-speaking woman 23 with ASD. Create schedule, facilitate community involvement, prefer experience with augmentative communication. Want a caring, committed person to support independence. Refs required and the phone number. So do you see how those ads would tend to attract people whose interest and experience would be more in keeping with your child or young adult's needs? So here's some other ways to get the word out. You could notify pertinent college departments, speech therapy, psychology, special ed, social work, occupational therapy, physical therapy. You could send a notice to church newsletters. And also in recent years, there are many more options on the Internet. There's Craigslist, which is in a lot of metropolitan areas around the country. Valerie's List is an example of a wonderful listserv in the San Diego area that gets sent out all over the country. And there's also online provider lists in your own community. If you want, you can develop a more comprehensive flyer that can be posted on bulletin boards. And be creative about where you put that flyer or who you send it to, because it's based on the unique family traits and needs of your child. So, for example, if you belong to a specific religious community, church, synagogue, temple, you might post the notice on the bulletin board there. Or if your child's on a special diet, you might post something at the health food store or post something at one of the university placement offices that's in your community. So here's an example of a flyer. Hello, I'm Ben, and I'm 8 years old. I like to swim, ride my bike, swing, and listen to music. I also have a label of autism. It's hard for me to sit still and pay attention. I need someone who will be patient and enjoy spending time with me. My parents want someone to come to my house 20 hours per week after school to tutor me, take me out in the community, and help me begin to learn more independence. Starting pay is $12 an hour. References are required. Experience with ASD is preferred, and the phone number. Of course, people might choose not to put a child's photo on the flyer for safety purposes, and you would also adapt the wording to apply to a young adult. So we've talked about how to get the word out, and the calls start coming in, and how are you going to screen these people? Because you will get people contacting you, whether you choose to do it by phone or by internet, or some people will set up a special voicemail, or people can leave a message. We've always screened by phone, but I have a bottom line, what I call a bottom line list, handy to refer to during that call, and I'll show you that in the next slide. Of course, the person who's going to be supported by this provider should participate in this process to the greatest extent possible. You should never deviate from your bottom line list in deciding who you will interview. If you allow your desperate need for help to interfere with your judgment, it can waste your time and set you up for problems in the future. Don't ignore your first impressions. Trust your gut. You'll hear me say that ad nauseum in this time. If something troubles you, err on the side of asking too many questions rather than not enough to set your mind at ease. And I have to admit, my work as a psychotherapy counselor has trained me to ask the right questions or to hear things that cause me to probe further. But I do believe that with practice, anyone can use their common sense to screen candidates wisely. The whole idea of screening is to eliminate people who don't match your needs and requirements. And I might end up talking to over 30 people, but only end up interviewing 2 or 3 of those people in person. So here's that sample bottom line list that we've used in our own situation. And your list might have some different items on it, but based on your own family needs. Again, I'm going to read it for people who aren't seeing the slide. Use of a reliable, safe car, a good driving record. They're okay with a criminal check. They have a comfort with diversity because that's an important value in our family. They're current in first aid or CPR or willing to do that soon. They have an interest in autism spectrum differences, whether or not they have a lot of experience. Even if they have an interest, that can be of value. No smoking on the job. Are they available to work the specific hours and days that we need somebody? Are they able to make a 1-year commitment in good faith? I don't want to train somebody who knew all the time that they were going to be leaving in the summer to go on a trip to Europe. But by the same token, I ask people for a 1-year commitment in good faith, but things still come up. Is the hourly pay that we're offering acceptable to them? Some people may not talk about pay till much later, but I just chose to broach that early on, because if somebody had high expectations for salary that was beyond our means, there was just no point of going further. And do they have solid references that can be checked? Regarding the amount of pay for providers, it's important to decide early in this process what your budget can allow. Most people make the assumption that one-to-one providers are going to be too expensive, but I do think there are creative ways to handle the financial end. For example, if you have an extra room in your home, you might consider a room and board exchange with an added stipend. This could be a great option for students, especially when their field of study is in a related area. Another creative option would be to offer benefits that will balance out that lower salary, such as use of a car or adding them on your medical insurance if you have a business policy. Maybe they would come along with your family on vacations. You might pay for continuing ed training that would enhance their work with your child. Also, in some states, there is money available to pay for providers. And I know that varies from state to state. Someone asked me what rate to pay for respite or one-to-one community inclusion or overnights, and that going rate is going to vary from state to state and even within different communities within a state. When in doubt, you could check local classified ads to see what salary people are offering, or ask county and state agencies that serve people with disabilities for their salary guidelines, or even better, talk with other parents who have already utilized one-to-one support for their own children. I've heard of hourly pay rates ranging from $8 an hour to $25 an hour, but ultimately, the pay should be based on what you can afford and the point at which a qualified provider will feel they are receiving adequate compensation. So normally I would stop and say, are there any questions? So it's kind of odd because you're listening to my voice, but I'm just going to stop here and check and see. Okay, somebody asked about ideas for funding, which I just sort of covered that. And if you want to talk further about that, I welcome people to email me at my website. So we are now on setting up that interview. You've had the people call. You got a few good candidates on the phone. Safety is an important consideration in deciding where to interview an applicant. Since we already had people working in our home, we felt comfortable interviewing at home. Other people might want to meet in a public location for the first time. I've always been surprised by the number of people who will spend 30, 45 minutes on the phone with being screened, set up an interview, and then not show up. Therefore, we learned to ask people to call when they're on their way. And if we don't hear from them, then we don't waste time waiting for them to show up. If that happens, no matter how desperate, we never chase after them if they no-show. Somebody once told me when you're hiring that people are at their best at the beginning. And if somebody is no-showing for an interview, that's not a good sign. Obviously, there's going to be exceptions. You know, if somebody, something, emergency happened and they couldn't call, but for the most part, you have to pay attention to how people come across in the beginning because that's usually they're putting their best foot forward at that point. Decide whether or not your child or the young adult will be present at the interview. Developmental readiness to participate should be balanced with giving your child the opportunity to have input to the extent they are able. This, after all, is the foundation of a self-determined life. Probably the chapter in my book I'm most proud of, Chapter 7, it's a chapter that gives specific suggestions for promoting self-advocacy from a young age. And in this case, in the context of how they can learn to speak up about whether or not they're comfortable with a prospective provider or even with a provider who's already supporting them. everything that an applicant says or doesn't say is grist for the mill. You can glean very useful information from someone from what is not said. They may leave out some information. And pay attention to what's not being offered. Making small talk with a person initially will help put them at ease, and it helps you to assess whether this person will be at ease and thus a good role model for your child in social situations. They also may have questions that arose since the screening phone call or whatever way you had of making contact initially. This is also good data for you whether this person will take initiative to ask questions. Look over their resume. Ask about schooling or life experiences that may have prepared them for this job. Don't hesitate to ask about time gaps or repeated job changes. We had one circumstance where somebody we were just about ready to hire, and I had a phone conversation with this person after the interview because I really wanted to find out why there was a 2-year gap on her resume. And she kind of took a breath and she said, "Well, I wasn't sure if I was going to tell you this, but now that you've asked, I had an eating disorder and I was in and out of the hospital during that time." Well, I immediately was concerned because my son had just recently gone on a gluten-free, casein-free diet, and I really wasn't sure it was such a good idea for somebody who had food issues to be working with my son on changing his diet. So this is kind of a funny story. So I went in the kitchen, and my husband was in there, and my son's provider at the time, and I told him the story. And the provider kind of took a breath, and she said, "Well, I was never going to tell you this, but I also am recovered from anorexia." And it was just amazing. And we did go ahead and hire this person, and she was wonderful. She might even be listening today. And she was with us for 3 years, and she moved away, and she is still in my son's life. So in that case, it worked out. But it still is important. If there's something you wonder about, don't hesitate to ask. Be willing to clarify your confusion. I'm sure many of you remember the Columbo approach. So in his TV role, Peter Falk was so skillful at asking questions that seemed innocent, but he went straight to the point. For example, suppose you notice a person's changed jobs 3 times in the past year. So the Columbo approach would be, instead of asking why directly, you might say, "Well, it certainly looks like you value variety in your jobs. What piqued your interest to move from job A to job B?" And then pay attention to what their answer is. Let's face it. You want your child or young adult to be safe and feel nurtured. The interview is a good time to assess your applicant's potential to be a good mentor or role model for your child. Temple talked about mentoring this morning as well. It's better to risk offending someone than to pass on the opportunity to ask a key question. Trust your instincts, mostly for an in-home position. You're not bound by legal restrictions on questions that can be asked, but this is my disclaimer that it's imperative you check with your own state Bureau of Labor to make sure that there's questions you cannot ask in an interview in that context. So now we're going to get to the meat of the matter after I take a little sip of water here. We all know that supporting a child who might have challenging behavior can be emotionally draining. Self-care is an essential issue to investigate with an applicant. That includes asking about hobbies or friends, areas of interest, physical fitness, etc. You also want to try and determine how this person might respond when pushed. I always ask, "How will we know when you're angry?" Or, "When is the last time you got really angry with someone?" If someone says, "I never get angry," red alert. I am more concerned about that than if they would say, "Well, I would come and ask to speak with you about it." We ask people, "What's your relationship with alcohol and other drugs?" We're not really asking, do you abuse drugs or are you addicted to alcohol?
Yeah.
We've got some noise coming in here on the phone. Most people in recovery will be very upfront about this. If someone says, well, I have a few drinks when I go out, I might ask carefully, well, how many is a few? Again, trust your gut here. That might seem like it's being personal, but you got to think about what it is that you're trying to hire this person to do. We actually didn't listen to our gut about that. We had somebody who had been a former crack addict and should have known better. And she actually was hired to be a live-in provider for my husband. And once again, we should have paid attention to the fact that she would have an occasional drink. And when things became very stressful in our family during a medical crisis, this woman began abusing alcohol, and we were left in a very bad situation at a very difficult time. So that issue is important to try and address in a subtle way. Essentially, this slide pertains to the types of questions that will allow you to find out how this person has handled challenges in their life and how well they set limits. So here's some sample questions. Tell me a time when you were asked to do something outside your comfort zone. How did you handle it? When was the last time you said no to somebody? Or what's been the most difficult challenge in a job, and how did you manage it? This slide relates to something a little different, and that's how a person's family background influences the way they might react to your child or young adult's behavior. Unless somebody has worked through their own childhood wounds, familiar reactions will most likely surface under stress. Perhaps an applicant had a parent who had a quick temper or got physical when provoked. You want to be sure they've dealt with that themselves. It's important to know their view of discipline, which I define as teaching desired behavior. In other words, telling your child what it is you expect of them rather than punishing them for what they're doing wrong, but not helping them to understand what it is that's expected. You want to listen for the importance that an applicant places on approaching a child on their child's terms with respect, especially early in the relationship. When our son was very young, we had a woman that we came close to hiring. And I remember in the interview, she had a lot of experience with autism, which in 1991 was kind of a scary thought because there was a lot of different ways that autism was viewed at that time. She put her hands around his waist and she lifted him up in the air and then she said, well, these kids tend to do this when I do this. And I remember kind of recoiling, but I was so desperate at that point to have some help. And I allowed the desperation to rule. And fortunately, this woman got a better offer for more money and backed out. And in the end, I was really relieved. She was not meeting my son where she was at, where he was at, with respect. You want to explore how this person resolves conflict. Do they engage in a power struggle? Or are they going to invest in listening actively to what your child may be struggling to communicate with or without words? These next two slides are what I call red flags. That is, if any of these issues become apparent in your interactions with an applicant, be cautious about going forward with this person. And I'm going to read them. Overly concerned with compliance. Tends to see behavior with negative intent. They're just assuming that if a child is having difficult behaviors, that they're doing it on purpose just to make you mad, which I think is a very dangerous assumption to have when you're trying to work respectfully with a child who's on the autism spectrum. Are they quick to defend or explain a position? Are they constantly interrupting you before you finish your question or not answering the question that you're asking? I've mentioned this earlier. Was the applicant severely punished as a child, but they haven't worked through it? And the issues around anger, are they somebody who stuffs anger and then potentially explodes? Kids or young adults with ASD can be abused in the name of compliance. An expectation of obedience doesn't take into account the unique nervous system, the sensory challenges, and the overall confusion about the world that may be present for a person on spectrum. That need for compliance may also show up in the person who seems anxious about being right or insists on defending or explaining their position to you before you move on. Some more red flags. Somebody who expresses discomfort with setting limits. They don't feel whole unless they're giving to others. Something that we used to call codependent. Or looking to this job to meet the bulk of their emotional needs for connection in their life. Or a period of recovery from addiction that isn't long enough. And something else that we found out was, does the applicant have a life partner who's actively abusing alcohol or drugs? And again, you're not always going to know this in an interview, but we have a person who's been with us for a long time who, when that person first started working for us, was married to somebody who was an active alcoholic. And it wreaked havoc on her life, and as a result, it wreaked havoc on ours. So that's something that we have learned to explore tactfully. But watch out for that person who comes across as emotionally needy. If someone talks a lot about their need to feel helpful, this can be a formula for disaster in terms of them reaching a level of burnout and resentment because they don't set good limits, or if they don't think you appreciate them enough for everything they're doing. You'll want to know more about whether this person has a life outside of their work. Do they have a strong support system? But at the other extreme, does a person have so much going on that they'll constantly need to fit you into their busy schedule? Balance is everything. So this, so far, may all seem overwhelming to many of you to consider going through this extensive process and asking all of these really personal questions. But in truth, spending more time up front to make a conscious and clear decision about what you need and what that best candidate might look like will pay off in spades. We currently have 4 people working for us who support my husband at home. One of them's been with us for 12 years, and another for 11. I believe that taking time at the front end was one major factor in having these providers stay with us for so long. Checking references could be an entire seminar, but in short, I suggest having a reference worksheet to fill out while you are talking with a person's reference. There's a sample of a reference checkoff in my book. Again, I'm saying trust your instincts. If there's an inkling of doubt, ask whatever you need to put your mind at ease. I'll tell you another story. We had another young woman who presented herself so well and showed some wonderful traits. And her only references were from back east, because I live in Oregon. And I would call somebody in South Africa if I had to check the reference. So I called somebody who she had put down as a friend of her family. She was a young woman in her 20s. And I told this man why we were checking her reference, what the job was, and he kind of took a breath and he said, "I cannot recommend this woman." He said, "She has paranoid schizophrenia, and when she goes off her medication, you do not want her living in your home." Now, I had a brother with paranoid schizophrenia. I don't mean in any way to dehumanize that population, but that's not the right candidate to be moving in our home and supporting our family. And if I hadn't checked that reference, I would have missed it, and we would have hired her. We were ready to have her move in. So it's very important. Don't be afraid to pry. You are entrusting this person with your precious child. Sometimes I will ask somebody who's a parent that maybe the person's given me, I'll ask for weird references like, give me the name of the parent of your best friend growing up. And those are not the kind of references people expect to give you. And I really find out about that person's family when they were growing up or what they might have been like when they were younger. Those are kind of important things to know. I might also ask somebody, if this were your child, would you have this person come into your home and take care of this child? Questions like that, you know, where you say to somebody, I need your help. I need you to be honest with me. But like I said, there's a lot to checking references. Now, I have covered everything it takes. Oh, I'm sorry, not everything. I've covered a great deal of what it takes to get that person hired. There is a lot more to this process that I don't have time to get to today. Things like, how do you orient a new person? How do you train them? How do you communicate with them on a daily basis? Or if you have more than one person supporting your child, how are you all going to communicate with each other? What kind of communication do you want this person to have with the IEP team? What kind of training do you expect them to get? How are you going to do performance reviews, whether you're going to do that formally or informally? And what are you going to do if you decide you need to terminate somebody? These are things that I covered in my book, but for obvious reasons, I don't have time to get to them. But the point I want to make right now is that you are prepared to nurture and train a worker. Both the experience of that provider and your family's experience is likely to be rewarding. You will have strangers who become an essential part of your family circle, even after they move on. The provider will receive outstanding training and have the blessing of working with your child or young adult. And I think it's important to see that they're lucky to be able to work with your child. It's also been meaningful to us that many of our son's providers have become valuable professionals in special ed. An added bonus for us to know that what they gained in our family, enhanced services to children and family in the larger community, locally and nationally, for those who've moved away. The last chapter of my book is entitled Everybody Wins. I'd like to share a few comments from former providers about what they personally gained from the experience, both professionally and personally. Laura said, I wanted to become a special ed teacher after college. Being an in-home provider allowed me to attend IEP meetings and trainings and to meet a variety of professionals. This experience helped me tremendously as I moved to graduate school and later into my first career as a learning specialist. As a special ed teacher, I am fortunate that I've seen the other side. I know what it's like to live with one child with autism outside the school environment. And then a more personal gain from Greg. As far as my future goes, I know now that I will always have a gift to be able to connect with all different types of people. I used to struggle with people's differences, and now I embrace them. My book is a comprehensive guide to all the aspects of hiring one-to-one support for children and young adults with ASD, and it's user-friendly. There's numerous examples, checklists, sample forms, questions to use as resource information every step of the way in the hiring process. And you can get it through my website or on Amazon, or it can be ordered through your local bookstore. So I'm going to take a minute and check to see if any more questions have come in during my talk. And if you have more questions after my webinar, as I said before, please feel free to email me through my website. If you're not seeing the slide, the website is disabilityinthefamily.com, and I'll be happy to respond. So let me check and see if I've had any other questions come in. There's one question here, and I think I may have answered that, but I still want to respond to this. We have difficulty hiring someone who would act as a job coach. They want to sit and just watch TV, but not really work. Are there any written or posted guidelines somewhere that we could use in the interview process and job write-up description to recruit someone who will work alongside of our son with a disability instead of just acting as a babysitter? Well, I think that I have really answered that question, but I wanted to respond directly to it. That if you take the time to figure out who you are as a family, what your needs are, what you expect, write that job description, screen people, ask the right questions in the interview, make sure you check references, then you're much more likely to have the person who will be performing according to the prescribed job description. And if there are no more questions, here's something. Somebody asked me about what's been the most difficult when it's come to child care. Was I ever able to enroll my child in a child care center? I imagine there are now centers that are designed specifically for children with autism. Deborah from Virginia asked that question. And there's different schools of thought about that, about whether our kids should be segregated just with people with the same diagnosis, or whether we should be aiming to have our kids in child care situations that are more inclusionary. And I think there are more inclusive child care centers out there. I think that's something worth Googling on the web, or checking in with your local ARC or your local United Way to find out who is out there that is wanting to include children. But for Jordan in 1991, there really wasn't the awareness. At the time that Jordan was diagnosed, we were told there were 5 in 10,000, and we all know what the statistics are now. So there wasn't the awareness. And actually, we didn't understand at that point what we needed, because I'm sort of going off topic here, but we as parents have to go through a developmental process of learning how to best communicate with our children. And when my son was first diagnosed, I had a steep learning curve about learning what it was that he really needed. Doing some counseling at the local Y. We used to live in Washington State, and they had a child care center right in the building, and I thought, oh, this is ideal, but it just never worked. It was too much stimulation for him. So that situation didn't work for him. And we tried preschool co-ops, and without the support of early intervention, because he didn't get the early intervention until he was about 3, those situations were not successful because, again, people didn't understand his unique neurology and weren't able to address his needs adequately. So, no, it did not ever work for us to put him in a child care center. That might be different today because, as I said, there is much more awareness. Okay, somebody asked where to acquire one of my books, and I've already divulged that information. And I think, unless there are more questions, that I am coming to a close. I'm just going to check one more time. And I want to thank all of you for listening, and I, again, welcome you to email me through my website. And I hope that you all enjoy the journey of having these wonderful, unique, quirky kids in your life. It's been the greatest gift and teaching for me in my own life. Thank you, and have a good evening.